Welcome to Awesome Movie Year, the podcast where we take a look back at an awesome year for movies, which is every year. My name is Josh Bell, film critic and writer, and I'm joined by my co-host.
I'm Jason Harris, filmmaker, comedian. And Josh, pick a number, one or two.
Two.
No! 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 No!
Okay.
No!
You're hurting our listeners, Jason. People are going to turn this off if you keep yelling at them.
Well, you know, like Don Logan, it's a very powerful answer to your response, Josh.
That it is. So in this season of Awesome Movie Year, we're talking about the films of the year 2000. And we're here at our first feature episode talking about the debut from a notable filmmaker, and it is Jonathan Glazer's Sexy Beast. Very timely. It's been a good year for Jonathan Glazer. He just won an Oscar for his film, The Zone of Interest. And so we thought this was a good time to look back at the beginning of his career. He's only made four films in the last 24 years, but every one of them has been basically like a major event, which is pretty impressive.
Yeah, he's 4 for 4. I was listening to The Big Picture last year, and Adam Neiman, the critic, was on, and he was saying how like the only filmmaker in the last 20 years who hasn't missed once is Kelly Reichert, which I think we would all disagree with.
Yeah.
But I think you can make the argument that Glazer hasn't missed.
Yeah, I mean, Kelly Reichert has made more movies, so she's had more chances to not connect or whatever. But I mean, it's also possible that someone who's this selective could take 6 years to figure out a movie and then put out something that just doesn't work. And that has not happened with Jonathan Glazer.
Right. Noah Baumbach, maybe?
I mean, I love Noah Baumbach, but I mean, I think Glazer is a better pick in terms of consensus, because I think all of his movies, well, maybe not Birth as much, but I think Birth has been pretty well reassessed. And otherwise, all of his movies are widely acclaimed.
Yes.
Thank you, Don Logan.
Yes.
So, of course, before this, he was not this major filmmaker that we're talking about with this track record, but he was a successful music video and commercials director, so a fairly known quantity when he showed up to direct this film. You know, it was a relatively small budget film. It did pretty well for that kind of film. It grossed $10.2 million on its budget of $4.3 million. And as Jason has already highlighted, it is most notable still for its performance by Ben Kingsley as Don Logan, the psychotic criminal who tries to get his former associate to return for one last job. Kingsley was nominated for an Oscar for Best Supporting Actor, which he lost to Jim Broadbent in Iris, a movie that no one remembers now.
I've never seen Iris. Have you seen it?
Maybe. If I have, I don't recall. But I mean, and I'm sure it's a good movie. I'm not saying that it's a bad movie or that Jim Broadbent gives a bad performance, but I think it's one of those things that was probably, you know, he had momentum for something at the moment, and it's not a movie that a lot of people watch now. But he did also win the Golden Globe, which he won over Ben Kingsley. But Kingsley picked up a bunch of awards from various critics groups and certainly was one of the most notable performances of this year.
Yeah, I mean, Josh, I think, you know, I've watched all four of the Glazer movies in preparation for this. Not that I hadn't, you know, I'd seen a couple, but I think this is the best performance of any Glazer movie by anyone.
Wow. I would go to bat for Nicole Kidman in Birth, but it certainly is a fantastic performance. I mean, and I think that's one thing, though. He gets great performances out of all these actors. You know, he comes from this music video and commercials background. And I think with someone like that, people often expect, oh, they're going to have a really impressive visual style, and they're really going to focus on the flashiness of the movie. And he does have an impressive style. And these movies are very visually accomplished, but I think he works really well with actors also.
I agree with you. I think he's the type of director that actors definitely want to work with, because Nicole Kidman, I think, is great in that movie. Obviously, we know Sandra Hüller in Zone of Interest, and really challenging performance by Scarlett Johansson in Under the Skin. I thought it was interesting. This is really the only kind of even Zone of Interest is more female dominated or more equal. This is really the only male dominated movie he's made.
Yeah. And it's a very kind of laddish, you know, genre, or at least that's what people think of. I mean, part of what's good about this movie is the way it subverts those expectations for people who maybe came into this not, of course, knowing who Jonathan Glazer was and thinking this was like a Guy Ritchie ripoff or something. And that's not the direction that it goes in at all.
Yeah. And Josh, it's interesting because he was this is like the 2002 Oscars he was nominated for. So I think that was like one of those things that just happened where it was like, hey, you know, with the release patterns out here or what's
yeah, this premiered at the Toronto Film Festival in September 2000, which is why we're talking about it as a 2000 movie, was released in theaters in the UK in January 2001, but didn't make it to US theaters until June 2001, which is why in the Oscars at the beginning of 2002, Ben Kingsley would have been nominated.
See, Josh, you got all the inside info.
Oh yeah, all the info listed on Wikipedia at my disposal. But yeah, I mean, release date patterns are always kind of strange, and you know, I know this is one of Dave's big pet issues. But this show, we've been pretty flexible. Sometimes we've talked about movies like this that have world premieres or festival premieres in the year that we're talking about, and commercial releases later. And sometimes we've done the opposite and talked about movies that were commercially released in the year that we're covering, but maybe did premiere earlier. So we're going with the flow here on Awesome Movie Year.
Mm-hmm. If I can quote one of Glazer's, probably his most famous music video, "Future's Made of Virtual Insanity."
Yes, indeed. I think there was some viral social media post when Zone of Interest, which is obviously a very serious film, was at the height of its acclaim, and someone posting the Jamiroquai clip like, this is directed by the same man who made the Zone of Interest.
Yeah, but I mean, he's a genius. Like, I think that's fair to say, because every project he tackles, he is so specific and there's such a point of view. And there are definitely themes like, you know, the real long takes for actors, which I think is Kingsley. There's that amazing take where he's like kicking in the cabinets in the kitchen where he's trying to recruit, you know, Gal into this. And, you know, each movie has these crazy long takes, this incredible sound design, you know, these kind of ambient shots that are really just there to let you breathe in whatever he's having you experience at the time. So I think, yeah, why wouldn't it be a very talented music video director could totally transition and do stuff like
that? Yeah, oh, totally. And I don't think this person was trying to necessarily denigrate him, but just show that that's kind of an amusing juxtaposition. But maybe he'll make the feature length Jamiroquai film next. That would be an interesting pivot after Zone of Interest.
Well, what's really interesting is we're talking about four movies, four different styles of movie, right? And, you know, I guess you would say really Birth and Under the Skin might be the closest in relation to kind of tone, but who knows what he's going to do next. So he's also, I mean, got a good sense of humor, as we learned from this film. So I'd like to see him jump back into something a little more comedic.
Yeah, and maybe after something that's so heavy like Zone of Interest, he'll do something a little lighter, but we may not know for another 6 to 8 years. I guess we'll see.
Yeah.
He's like Terrence Malick, you know, in the 70s.
Right. Yeah.
Only the two movies though.
Yeah. So. And I, you know, as we learned from Terrence Malick, everyone wished for him to make movies more often. And then it was kind of a monkey's paw situation when he started doing that. So,
well, I mean, you know, I think with Malick, you're like, hey, sure. If he wants to turn out 10, and half of them go down as like great Malick films, that's a batting average you'll take.
Yeah, I mean, and you know, that's off topic here, but someday, well, I'm sure we'll talk about Terrence Malick.
We got it.
So critics were generally quite positive about this film as well. Owen Gleiberman in Entertainment Weekly said, "Ben Kingsley came to prominence flashing a Mona Lisa smile of eternal compassion as the saintly Mahatma Gandhi, and you could make out his halo in Schindler's List as well. Now, in the cleverly diabolical Sexy Beast, Kingsley adds a welcome megavolt of electricity to the summer season by playing one of the nastiest, crudest, most vicious specimens of vile sociopathic scum since Joe Pesci shot a bullet into Michael Imperioli's foot for the jolly sadistic fun of it in Goodfellas. Sexy Beast is a British indie underworld drama that puts Hollywood's recent inflated attempts at entertainment to shame. The director, Jonathan Glazer, is a music video veteran who works with all the classicism and flair that Guy Ritchie, with his hiccupy, Ritalin jump cut style, can only dream about."
I think that is a personal choice for Guy Ritchie, obviously.
It's not like
he's forced to, you know, have that hiccupy flair or whatever. But no, I mean, this is, you know, that's the other big kind of probably discussion point is like this subgenre of British gangster movies, which there's a, you know, a great tradition of, and there's a lot of really good movies in that genre.
Yeah. And I think it's also interesting that now I feel like, and I mean, speaking of one of the stars of this film, Ray Winstone, I just watched the Netflix TV series of Guy Ritchie's The Gentleman, and is full of this, like, you know, as if it's an AI generated Guy Ritchie clone kind of thing that we're very used to, that I think has gotten tiresome. But I thought it's interesting here that in the year 2000, after which Guy Ritchie had made what, three films maybe or something like that, people are already like, oh yeah, that Guy Ritchie style, we're not having it anymore.
Well, I mean, you know, it's that was a direct like, hey, I'm going to, you know, kind of use an amalgam of what Scorsese was doing in the 70s and the stuff that Tarantino was doing in the 90s and just kind of like even turn it up a little more. And it's still going. So he somehow keeps making moves.
Somehow.
So. No, I mean, you know, again, like he's made some good movies over the years.
Yeah, I don't mind. There's some Guy Ritchie movies that I think are fun. But I mean, I think it's interesting here, too, though, that Owen Gleiberman makes this comparison to Goodfellas, obviously connecting Glazer to Scorsese more strongly than Ritchie. And I think that's a comparison that most people would make rather than the other way around.
I think, yeah, you could do that now, especially because, you know, obviously Scorsese is most known for, you know, the gangster movies, but he's made so many different types of movies also. So I think that's a fair thing.
Yes. Yes, indeed. So Desson Thompson in the Washington Post, also quite positive. He said, in the assured hands of director Jonathan Glazer and writers Lewis Mellis and David Shinto, Sexy Beast is a Molotov cocktail of a movie, an engaging conflagration of British B-flick, Cockney wit, and gallows humor. There's even a delicate little love story in there. It's a gas and a half to spend time with these characters and the performers who play them. Kingsley, such a magnificent actor, makes it his personal business to be the nastiest villain in recent memory. He's disconcertingly successful, whether he's angrily reacting to the Spanish plane crew that makes the mistake of asking him to put out his cigarette or intimidating the hell out of Gal and his friends.
Well, so part of the Kingsley thing that makes it so incredible is he's like petite, right? He's slight. He's a very slight figure, right? And I mean, obviously you had referenced Gandhi and, you know, a lot of people know him from that, but of course he was doing other great work, but, you know, that kind of figure you would think would lead to, you know, someone more on the side of good and whatnot. So when you have this little bulldog coming at you, like, and not letting go ever, it really, really is quite amazing. So I really did think that is the height of this movie. You know, he's the best thing in the movie.
Yeah, no,
and it's a good movie anyway.
Right, but I agree with you. Yeah, he really carries it so much. And it's not only is Kingsley himself kind of a slight, smaller person, but the way that they dress Don Logan in those starchy, like, white button-up shirts, you know, he looks like he's a mid-level corporate accountant
teacher.
or something like that.
High school chemistry
teacher. The least intimidating possible way that you could have him dress. And yet, immediately, we are intimidated by him in the audience. Like, that intimidation comes across so strongly right away.
And I think, you know, you brought up the last review brought up Pesci and Goodfellas, and you're like, well, this guy's a madman and an insane person. But I think the word you used, intimidating, for Kingsley here, is there aren't many villains who are this intimidating in the entirety of film history.
Right, right. Mm-hmm. You're like 100% like, yes, I would also be terrified of this man.
Mm-hmm. It's so funny because, you know, speaking of the Oscars this year, we know that best short film winner, Wes Anderson, The Wonderful Story of Henry Sugar. Yeah. Is that what it is? Yeah. And again, he's playing such a sweet, like, kind of almost zened out character, Kingsley, in that one. And then this is just such a, it just shows like what a talent he is to take this role. And, you know, when Ray Winstone signed for this movie, they offered him any part he wanted. And I think I don't think anyone could have done this role better than Kingsley. So I'm glad Winstone took the lead as Gal.
Right.
Because he's great too. But Kingsley really is just the cream of the crop here.
He is indeed. So Derek Ely in Variety was more critical, and I don't agree, but I feel like it was interesting to get some slightly negative response here. He said, "All dressed up with nowhere particular to go, Sexy Beast is an often enjoyable, massively uneven Brit ganglander with an almost surreal approach to the genre. Strongly cast, with a jaw-dropping perf by Ben Kingsley as a foul-mouthed Cockney gangster, and impregnated throughout with first-time director Jonathan Glazer's music vid commercials background, this dark comedy drama about a retired villain lured back from Spain to London for one final job could rustle up some business with a sexy ad pub sell, but leaves a curiously hollow feeling once the lights go up. It's not the kind of film to be approached with classical perceptions of narrative or form. Glazer and scripters Lewis Mellis and David Shinto have constructed a rich paella that mixes star routines with unreal moments, comedy with graphic violence, and melancholy with sad romance. Several are memorable on their own, without any of the parts adding up to a satisfying whole."
You ever have paella, Josh?
I have not, but I thought you'd appreciate the culinary reference in there.
You got to use one of those big pans. I think it's called a ziggurat, and that way you can cook the rice and get that crunchy bottom on the bottom there. So, you know, that's important.
It is a Spanish dish, right? I think that's why he's referenced it. Yeah,
it's probably the national dish of Spain. I've written about paella a number of times, Josh.
Did this movie remind you of paella?
Not at all. So maybe bangers and mash or something.
Yeah.
These two reviews both mentioned the romance angle, and that is more of a plot device than, a component that stands out. I don't really think either, they're really there just to kind of advance the story for both the guys here. And the women are fine, but they don't really have much to do in this movie.
Yeah, that's true. The female characters don't do much, but I did feel like the romance or the sort of, spousal love or marital love between Gal and Dee Dee was actually really effective. And it's effective not because Dee Dee gets to be a fascinating, well-rounded character, but as an aspect of this gangster character that you really don't expect. I think, you're conditioned by these gangster movies, these British gangster movies, especially, that these are going to be these horrifically misogynistic characters. And a lot of times they beat their partners or whatever. And Gal just loves his wife so much. And I feel like that really comes across. And he's just this like big sweetheart, which also makes Don even more of a villain. Cause you're like, oh, he's just this teddy bear. And Don is like bashing his brains in, metaphorically.
Yeah. Well, I mean, he chose a life of crime. So, I'm sorry, you don't get off scot-free.
I mean, he chose to get out of his life of crime. And, sometimes people don't have their options are limited when they come from impoverished backgrounds. We don't know.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you could argue that, he's really a robber. He's not hurting anyone physically.
Right.
He's just taking money. So, you're right, Josh. I apologize, Gal. I'm not judging.
Yeah. I think Gal is meant to be quite likable, right?
He is quite likable.
Yeah.
So is H.
Yes. His buddy.
The friend.
Yes. Yeah. And the women too. I mean, like you said, they don't get a lot to do. We don't learn a lot about them, but when we see them, we do like them. I mean, because they're all pitted against Don, I feel like anyone against Don, we're on their side.
Right. And Don, he gets his comeuppance, but you're like, oh man, I wish Don was still on screen after that.
Yeah. Yeah. We'll talk about that more, I'm sure. But, so Jason, you're catching up with all of Glazer's work. Had you not seen this one before?
No, I saw this in the theater
when
it was out, and I didn't connect with it as much as I did this time. I liked it better. I hadn't seen it since the theater. I saw Zone of Interest last year while we were prepping our little Oscar season stuff, and then this week I watched Birth and Under the Skin. But yeah, this was the second time I've seen this one.
Yeah, this was the second time for me as well, although I did not see it in the theater. I had just caught up with it randomly in like 2016, I think Letterboxd told me, on video, just as a movie that was notable. And I think probably, I mean, this was a well-reviewed movie and obviously Oscar nominated at the time it came out. But I think probably as Glazer started making more movies that were even more highly acclaimed, it became a bigger and bigger deal. So I wanted to watch it. And I quite liked it then, and I quite liked it now as well. I mean, as you just referenced, one of its issues is what happens to the movie when Don is not on screen. But, you know, we'll talk about that. But overall, I liked it both times. I'm glad to have watched it. I didn't remember a ton about it, so it was fun to revisit. Dave, had you seen this before?
I had not seen any of his three previous films, and all three of them were like high on my watch list for years. And so I was glad to get a chance to just binge them all.
Yeah. So we're all now fully Glazer experts here, I guess.
Did you guys watch The Fall, the short film?
I didn't. I was going to try to squeeze it in, but I didn't. But you've seen that, right, Jason?
King of the Glazers.
Anything else you want to say about the background of this film, Jason?
Well, Josh, you were just talking about how in 2016 you were watching this because you thought, like, as Glazer made more films, that this got maybe more of a reputation. But I also think part of that is the reputation of the performance. Like, you know, when people just talk about movies, this is the type of, oh, you want to see a crazy villain? You got to watch this movie. So I think that was part of the reason that it caught on so much. Anthony Hopkins sent Ben Kingsley a letter of admiration, just telling him how much he enjoyed his performance. So that's pretty nice.
Yeah. Two sirs there expressing mutual respect.
Two sirs with love.
Yeah, exactly.
For each other.
From one sir with love to another.
Yeah, exactly. And I did like that Ben Kingsley based the Don Logan character on his grandmother.
Man, what kind of grandma did he have? Jeez.
Yeah, that would be weird. Grandma, I don't want any broccoli. I'm not going to eat it. No, no, you eat your broccoli. You're going to eat your broccoli. You're going to eat your broccoli.
We'll come back in a moment and talk more of our general thoughts on Sexy Beast. Welcome back to Awesome Movie Year. In this episode of our season on the films of the year 2000, we are talking about our first feature pick, Jonathan Glazer's Sexy Beast. And Jason, my question for you is, who or what is the Sexy Beast?
Oh, I think, if I'm not mistaken, because we do see the Beast character in there, you know, from in his dreams and in his hallucinations. Maybe the Beast is just that kind of ongoing commitment to that has no choice. When they call on him, he has to answer the call because of the life he chose. That's my thought on that. What about you?
Yeah, I didn't think of that, but one review, and I don't know if it's one I quoted or another one that I read, did essentially say that the Sexy Beast is like that allure of the gangster life. And I like that. I hadn't thought of that at all. I was being much more literal, especially because when the title shows up, we have that great freeze frame of Gal getting
of his dog.
Yeah, of him, the most unflattering possible angle on his body as he gets up from that chair in his little Speedo or whatever. And I just connected it directly to that. Like, oh, Gal is he's a sexy beast, where it's kind of ironic. But I like the metaphorical version of it better. I feel like that's more elegant and less condescending to the character. So I'm gonna go with you on that.
Dave, I just out film, you know, metaphor Josh. What do you think of that?
That was good stuff. Yeah, you got him.
did you have an opinion on it, Dave?
I actually was thinking along the same lines as Jason. Like, I thought it was just the lifestyle. It was the thing that drags you back no matter what.
Right. Well, I guess you guys were ahead of me because I hadn't made that connection.
That's okay, Josh. We're here to, you know, kind of uplift you, so don't worry about
Thank
it.
Thank you.
But, you know, this is a good spin on a very typical gangster movie trope or crime movie trope of, hey, just when I think I'm out, they pull me back in, right? The one last job one. And they have some good twists and turns in here, right? So, you know, to spoil certain things here, Josh, when Gal finally does the job, it's because he has to kind of protect his wife and himself because of what happened with Don. And the Teddy character, played by Ian McShane, knows what happened, but is waiting for Gal to admit it. And he won't admit it. But so Teddy just pays him a $10, you know, 10 pounds for the entire job. And it's great because he gives him a 20 and demands change, right? You know, so he really sticks it to him. So I thought, like, little things like that, like the humiliation and just like the, how am I actually going to get back to living the life that I want, were really good elements of this, as opposed to just like, oh, it's the lore of One Last Job and I got to do it because it's too big to not do.
Right. And I did like that because he's retired and he's been retired for some amount of time, like years, it seems like, that presumably he already did One Last Job. And, you know, the cliches of these gangster movies is the characters are always like, oh, this is our one last score. We're going to get out and be set for life. And then it all falls apart. But for Gal, it worked out just that way, right? He obviously did something, got all the money he needed, bought this really nice Spanish villa, is sort of living this life of luxury. So already from the beginning, it's subverting what you expect out of one of these movies. And then you're right, like he's lured back in, but he's not lured by the sexy beast, right? He's not in any way tempted to return to his life of crime. It's just the terror of what Don will do. And then, as you said, the consequences potentially of what they do to Don that forces him to go back and do that job.
Yeah, the whole thing is very strange because, like, structurally, you're like, okay, it opens with this really funny voiceover where Gal is just like, it's hot out, sizzling. You could, you know, fry an egg on my chest. And he just keeps going and going. And then he kind of doesn't really do that for the rest of the movie. And the voiceover comes in sporadically. It's basically like 45 minutes of scenes of Don yelling at Gal to do the job, right? And you're like, huh? In lesser hands, this would have not worked out at all, but he made it. They all made it work.
I thought your introduction, Jason, was going to be like the voiceover. I thought that's how you're going to start the show.
Well, I am wearing a yellow bikini right now.
Nice.
So
nice.
That counts for something, right?
Yeah. I mean, it's essentially divided kind of into, you know, and it's a short film. It's under 90 minutes, and it's essentially divided into kind of three parts. Like before Don shows up about 20 minutes into the film, we have what you're describing, which is basically just the good life that Gal and Dee Dee are living along with H and Jackie, his, I don't know if she's meant to be his wife or his girlfriend or whatever she is, but she's, you know, they're all together and they're going out to dinner together and they're shopping and they're just hanging out and having fun. And then they learn that Don is coming and it kind of puts this pall over everything that's going on. And then the middle stretch, which is the best part of the movie, when Don is there and he is just yelling at them the whole time. And then for a while too, because I didn't remember that much about this movie, I thought, oh, what's cool about this is that this is going to be a movie where they keep talking about the job and they never do the job. And that's not what happens. And the final third of the movie where he has to go do the heist, even though he didn't want to, is good. And it's a cool kind of depiction of a heist. And Ian McShane is a good villain in a different mode than Ben Kingsley. But I felt like a lot of it deflated at that point.
I agree with you. And it's also stylistically a little different, right? It really feels like more of a classical heist movie at that point in time. And the pacing's a little different. And, you know, that is the structure, like you said, that was chosen. But also it's just you've gone down the big drop. You've done the roller coaster with the most exciting character in here. So, you know, it holds its own. It's just, it can't crescendo the same way.
Right. And I think Glazer maybe even realizes that a bit and is trying to extend Don's presence, because it's a linear film until the moment at which they're going to, you know, kill Don and Dee Dee shoots him. And then we cut away and there's Gal in England doing the job. And then we have some periodic flashbacks to see the ultimate fate of Don so that we can still get little snippets of him as we're into this next section of the film.
Yeah, I was really impressed by that, because the last thing you see is Dee Dee holding a gun. And like you're saying, they subvert the expectations. You don't know what happens. They just cut from her pointing the gun at Don to Gal in England, like getting ready for the job.
Right. And maybe you assume like, oh, he had to give in after all. And because Don has easily disarmed their pool boy there who was going to shoot him, you figure, oh, he probably did the same thing to Dee Dee, or maybe he even killed Dee Dee, and that's even worse. But that's obviously not what happened. And that is a part of that subversion too.
Yeah, I think the only thing I would have wanted from this movie is interaction with Don and Teddy. That would have been really good, because there are such monsters, those two. They're both so great on screen also. Like, it would have been an interesting thing, but, you know, it doesn't all fit all the time.
Yeah, we have, I think, don't they have brief interactions when Don is describing the setup for the job to Gal, and we see some flashes of him having meetings with people?
I guess, I mean, that you probably got me on that one, but that's like you know, someone's explain. Well, didn't they explain it to Stan? Teddy explained it to Stan, and Stan explained it to Don, and Don explained it to Gal. So I don't even know if that was an actual interaction, or, you know, even with those cuts, you never really got those two together.
Right.
But I did want to, you know, I referenced that scene earlier where I think it was probably my favorite scene in the movie. It's this weird angle where the camera is facing into the kitchen, right? And this was originally, I think, a set in like a living room where they're just in chairs together, and Glazer moved the scene for shooting. And it's, they're facing in, and it's, again, it's Don pressuring Gal to do the job, right? And you kind of see Gal's face a little obscured, but you don't see Don's face. It's all in long shot. It's one long shot, and it's one long take of this long shot. And that's where Don is kicking in the cabinets and doing all this stuff. And I think like that is the scene where you're like, hey, if I'm an actor, this is a guy I want to act for, because look at what he lets me do, right? He's going to let me go all the way with the performance. And again, take what you think you're going to see and twist it in a different way.
Yeah, that is a great analysis of that scene. And I think even if we're looking at, we've also, Kingsley has established Don so well, and Glazer has showcased him so well, that even if we're just looking at the back of his head at that point, we're already intimidated just by that, right? Because we know what that means, I think.
I wonder how much Glazer knew of how Kingsley was going to play this character, or did he just show up to set and was he just like, you know, this is one of the great actors of all time, let's just let him go. And then when he got it, he was already there.
Right. I mean, how much of that is in, I mean, I assume all the great language that Don uses and the elaborate insults and all that is in the script. So, you know, that, but it could be delivered definitely in a different kind of way. And you could imagine maybe even another actor deciding, oh, what's going to be most intimidating about this guy is if he's just imposing and he doesn't have to yell or whatever, and people are scared of him anyway. And you could see someone like Anthony Hopkins maybe doing it that way, but it works really well the way Kingsley does it.
Yeah, I think you're right in that, like, the language is there, but maybe not the, you know, like, I'm, you know, I kept doing the no, no, no's, right, and the yeah, yeah, yes. I don't know if that was, it could have been scripted, or that could have just been like the actor's heightening and Kingsley taking it up to that next level. The other great scene with Don, I mean, there's a few of them, right? Yeah, there's the one scene where he's in the bathroom alone and he pees on the floor just because F you, that's why.
Well, not
right?
only does he pee on the floor, but the way he pees, even when he's peeing in the toilet.
Oh, deliberate. Yeah, right? Deliberate.
And it's like, yeah, he's got his hands on his hips and he's just like the power and strength that he has is really great the way they shoot that too from behind.
Right. But the rest of that scene is him looking in the mirror and kind of telling himself what a loser he is and how bad he is at getting things done, right? So that kind of self-hatred in there is a really interesting thing that I don't think we see at any other point in the film.
Right, and I think it gives you some good insight maybe into him as a person, even though you don't like sympathize with him. I mean, moments like that in other films might be meant to show you this villain is a human being with flaws and maybe you can understand where they're coming from. And I suppose that's it, but you don't, he's still horrible and you still really want them to kill him.
I didn't. I mean, I was okay with it, but I also could have used more Don Logan. You know?
Well, right. I mean, I think from the perspective of enjoying his presence in the movie, you don't want him to be bumped off. But I think from the perspective of like what you want for the characters or what you're rooting for to happen in the story, like he's awful. You want him to get killed. Yeah.
So we should talk about other elements, but I did also want to just bring up the scene where, so, you know, Gal actually confronts Don and he says, the reason you're here isn't to recruit me. It's because you're still in love with Jackie H, his wife. And, you know, he found that hot button for him. He pressed it and Don is so upset. And, you know, that's when he even calms down a little and he just is like, you know what? I'm out of here. Right. He gets on the plane and the plane scene and the aftermath of the plane scene is excellent.
Yeah.
Where Don won't put out his cigarette, so he is aggressively kind of walks off the plane or is escorted off. And then when he has to deal with that's beyond airport security. What would you call that?
I don't know. It wasn't clear to me if that was meant to be like a police officer or some official, because I'm sure what you're about to describe is the way that Don kind of gets out of his being right in trouble is that he lies and says that the gay flight attendant has sexually harassed him. And I would have to think that if that was a police officer, he would be like, whatever, you're still under arrest. Whereas if it's an official from the airline who's like, I want to avoid a, you know, scandal or something like that, that's why they let him go. So I was not sure about that.
Right. He does say he touched his front body.
Right, exactly. Right. The way he describes everything is so incredibly awkward in all cases. Yeah,
exactly. That's true. That's one of the beauties of it. So, I mean, you know, we have clearly established that Kingsley is the height of this movie, although everyone else is doing a good job too. I think Glazer, every movie he makes, he really utilizes the locations really well. You know, Spain, especially in this one, is just beautiful and interesting. So I like that element. And I wanted to ask you what you thought of the heist.
I mean, like you said, I think the heist is cool. And he does have an unconventional approach to it. The idea that they're drilling into this vault from next door, which is a very common heist movie thing, but they have to drill through this like Turkish bath. And thus the vault itself ends up flooded. And it's a very beautiful kind of thing. Also extremely impractical. As some review noted, why don't they just drain the water out of the Turkish baths first?
Well, because the water flooded the vault, so it shorted out their security system.
Oh, okay. I mean, they couldn't have just smashed it. It's not like no one's going to know what's going on there in the vault, that something bad has happened when they open it the next day and it's full of water. But
less cinematic.
Yeah, right. Exactly. I think that is really the reason, as you said. It is beautiful. It's cinematic. It looks cool. And it provides this kind of dreamlike setting. There's no dialogue while they're underwater. So it gives Gal this chance to reflect a little, or you get some of his internal sense. So it's cool. It's just, like I said, I was thinking, oh, what's great about this movie is that they don't ever actually do the heist. And I obviously remembered it wrong, and they do the heist. But I think by that point, you're like, I don't really care whether the heist goes off or not. That's not what this movie is about. And as enjoyable as it is to watch, it feels like an afterthought.
I think you're right. It's a device. I mean, like you said, it is cool. They're all underwater, you know. Gal is able to swipe some earrings for his wife and everything. But the best part of that is when he opens up an urn and all the kind of remains of someone just kind of get in his breath and he has to stop doing it. But yeah, that's more of, again, a device to get us back to what happened to Don and the interaction between Teddy and Gal at that point.
Yeah. And as you said, too, like Ian McShane, of course, great actor. Teddy is a cool villain, but Teddy is more of like the kind of villain you expect from one of these movies. He's this calm, collected boss who will kill you without a second thought, and everyone knows it. And he doesn't have the presence that Don Logan has. But I do want to kind of push back on one thing you said, that he humiliates Gal at the end there when he has to get him. I guess Gal never quite admits it or whatever, but Teddy knows that Gal has killed Don. And it doesn't seem like Teddy really cares about Don at all, or even that.
He says he doesn't even.
Right.
I gave one shit about
Right, him. Right. Exactly. Or even that he's been sort of, that Teddy himself has been sort of betrayed in that Don was his like guy that he sent out there to recruit Gal, and Gal has killed him. And he gives Gal that 10 pounds and sends him on his way. But I feel like Gal totally gets out of it exactly what he would hope. Like, he didn't want to do the job in the first place. He obviously didn't need the money. So 10 pounds is fine. And as you said, he gets that jewelry for his wife. He gets to live and return to his life in Spain and will never, ever be harassed by Don Logan again. To me, it's a win-win-win for him.
Oh, I'm not disagreeing with that. I'm just saying that, you know, I think the intention of Teddy there was like, hey, I can do whatever I want with you. You're getting 10 bucks and you're lucky that that's what you're getting.
I think you're right. But I think in a way, Teddy fails because he doesn't realize how much Gal also doesn't care. And 10 bucks is 10 bucks more than he ever wanted out of the job in the first place.
Yeah, you might be right. I mean, maybe it was a favor to Teddy also, because Don is not an easy character to deal with.
True.
So maybe this opens things up more for Teddy as well.
Right. I mean, the other thing about Don is like, he seems to have been a successful criminal, but you know, to pull off that heist, they need a lot of teamwork. And Don does not seem like a team player.
Well, and he really couldn't get Gal to go along with doing the job. So he didn't, he wasn't succeeding in his job either by just bullying him.
Yeah. I want to talk a little more about the Beast, the actual Beast, not the metaphorical sexy Beast, but this sort of like rabbity character that, or creature that Gal keeps imagining. It was cool looking, but I felt like I was a little, I didn't really know what to make of it.
Well, I mean, that's fair. I think with Zone of Interest, you know, you had all those kind of like night vision scenes, and those were tough for me to figure out what was going on in that too. I think that's just a recurring Glazer theme. He likes to not give you a lot of answers in Birth. You don't really get a lot of answers till the end of Act Two, and you know, Under the Skin, the big reveal towards the end is interesting. So I think that's just a Glazer thing.
Yeah, and I don't dislike it necessarily. Like I said, it looks cool, and you can just guess. It's like, oh, this is some sort of manifestation of Gal's fears, or the danger of the world that he's in, or the danger of Don Logan, or whatever. But it felt out of place in a way with the otherwise more grounded tone of the film, as opposed to maybe other Glazer movies.
Josh, did it make you feel like you were sweating like a cunt?
I think I forget. I don't know what the exact number is, but you know, people always talk about the number of times that Tony Montana says fuck in Scarface, you know, to the point where it's like, you know, a band name. But I think that might be a record here for the use of that word as well as fuck in this film too.
The word cunt is used 21 times in the movie. There the word go. Fuck is used 115 times in the movie.
Mm. Well, maybe not a record because of course it's 182 times in Scarface.
Yeah. I know Jeremy Thomas, the producer who was the producer on this and who we talked about in our Last Emperor episode, is a major producer.
No uses of the word fuck in the Last Emperor, I don't think.
And maybe that would have changed everything Manchico. But he said the American studio, whoever bought it, their legal department said, you can't make the movie because of all the cunts and the fucks in there. But they made it and it worked out.
Yeah. And it's rated R. And so they must not have had to cut any of the uses of that those words. So good for them.
You know, Glazer, like I said, is really good at sound design and music. I love the song in the opening, the Strangler song Peaches is really good. I just think this is something that he continues to elevate as he makes more movies.
Yeah, I mean, and it's obviously not surprising that someone who came from making music videos knows how to use music well in his films.
Lack of Jamiroquai, though.
We're just waiting for it. The next film, full soundtrack by Jamiroquai. It's going to happen.
I'd watch it.
Yeah, of course. So did you have any thoughts, Dave, that you wanted to add?
No, I mean, I think you guys covered it. I mean, I thought the Teddy character was really great. Like, I think you guys kind of like said he kind of took a backseat to, you know, some of the other stuff. But I actually really liked him. I loved every time he was on screen. Even if it is similar to a lot of other, you know, British gangster characters, I just thought McShane really, you know, just nailed it. He was just so good in that role. But of course, it's Ben Kingsley's movie.
Right. I mean, and I think the fact that Ian McShane, who is great, doing a really good job playing a character and yet is still overshadowed by what Kingsley does, shows you how amazing Kingsley's performance is.
Yeah, absolutely.
Jason, do you want to rate this out of five no's?
Five? No! It's 3.5 no's from me. No! No! No!
Okay. I keep thinking of the Knights Who Say Knee from the Monty Python and the Holy Grail. I'm with you. I'm giving it 3.5. It's a really enjoyable movie. I do just feel like it kind of drops off a little in that final act, but happy to revisit it and definitely worth seeing. Dave, how would you rate this?
I went to 4. I think it's a great movie. And along with all of his other movies, they're all a solid level of 4, really.
Yeah, he's an impressively consistent filmmaker. So we'll talk more about that and come back and get into the legacy of Sexy Beast. Welcome back to Awesome Movie Year. In this episode of our season on the films of the year 2000, we are talking about Jonathan Glazer's Sexy Beast. And we've really talked extensively here already about Glazer's career, as a filmmaker, he only has these three other films, Birth, Under the Skin, and The Zone of Interest, all of which, as Jason said, very different kinds of films, but with this incredible command of style and tone and the visuals and working with actors and everything, all really fascinating films to watch.
Yeah, and I keep saying sound design. I feel like you got to really throw that in there.
Yeah.
In those movies. How would you rate the four, top to one through four, Josh?
Well, Under the Skin, I haven't seen since it was in the theater, whereas I did rewatch Birth recently for an article, and of course, Zone of Interest is a recent release. So given that my memory of that one is a little fuzzy, I really like Birth. I would put that at the top, maybe Under the Skin under that, and then this. And I was sort of mixed on Zone of Interest. So, it's hard to say because, as Dave said, they're all so solidly great that you almost just want to rank them all evenly.
And Dave, what about you?
Yeah, I also have Birth at the top. I just really loved that one. And Nicole Kidman is so good in that movie. I would probably put Sexy Beast number two, and then Under the Skin. I really appreciated Zone of Interest. I think it's a great movie. It's just not the kind of movie that I'm going to watch multiple times. So it definitely goes at the end for me.
Yeah, so I agree with you on that. Like, I mean, I probably would want to watch it one more time, but that's number one for me, Zone of Interest. Sexy Beast is two and the most rewatchable out of these. I have Birth at three, but I think Birth, it really is like that twist that comes along, whether you go along with it or not, is really the make or break. But obviously, I agree with the Nicole Kidman thing. Under the Skin is my least favorite. I think it is a little more plotting than the rest of them. And that is, I get why from a story standpoint, but it just didn't knock me out as much as the rest of them.
Yeah, and I'd be curious to revisit that because, like I said, it's been however many years since I saw it when I saw it in the theater, and it was just such a singular experience. You come out of it, and I feel like it's almost like I don't even know how to respond to this.
I think that's fair, and almost fair for all of his movies, as we see with some misinterpretations of The Zone of Interest right now, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. He does, I mean, as selective as he is about making feature films, he fills in, he does continue to work on commercials and music videos. And I mean, I don't know the reason why he doesn't make films more often, if it's that he's had difficulty getting financing together for his films, which are, of course, very challenging, or if it's his choice. But maybe given all the acclaim for The Zone of Interest, he'll be able to put together his next project more quickly.
If he wants to, it could just be that that's what he does.
Right.
He's living his life, bro.
and as well he should.
Yeah, because there's nothing in development right now. I mean, it would be interesting to, like, I never want to see, like, these kind of auteurs make us, you know, quote unquote studio movies. But it would be interesting to see what he does with a studio
movie. Do you want him to make a Marvel movie?
Yeah, he needs to reboot,
Howard the Duck?
Any of that. Sure, let's go with that. I'd be down for that. So, yeah, Josh. So the co-writers here, David Shinto, Lou Melles, they have written other movies in this genre, 44-inch Chest and Gangster Number One. And Lou Melles is the voice of Darth Sion in Star Wars, Knights of the Old Republic to the Sith Lords.
Sure. Yeah. Have you seen other? I know you like the British gangster movies a lot. Have you seen either of those other two?
No, I have Gangster Number One on my list there. I was going to, yeah, we should talk about, like, I do like British gangster movies. I like some of the ones that we've talked about already, some of the Guy Ritchie ones. Do you have any favorites, Josh?
I mean, I feel like I'm less well-versed, and I should probably have looked this up. I mean, one movie that's compared to this a lot that I know you really like, and I liked a lot too, although I haven't seen it in a long time, is Steven Soderbergh's The Limey.
I love The Limey, and I think that's a great reference point. I think Layer Cake is a really good one. Lock, Stock, and Two Smoking Barrels. And then, of course, Dave and I will take the prize for In Bruges.
Yeah, I can't get on board the McDonough train. But I did like Layer Cake before Matthew Vaughn became this horrible, soulless parody of a filmmaker.
I mean, we've talked about this before in other episodes. If any filmmaker has kind of failed on the promise of their potential more than our friend Kevin Smith, but I think it's Matthew Vaughn might be the answer after this past year.
Yeah,
with Argyle,
it's not even. I mean, Layer Cake is fun. I don't remember it being like brilliant, but I think he took all the wrong sort of directions from that from the success of that film and what he went on to do later. But maybe we'll talk about him.
He made a few good things back.
Yeah. So, you know, we were talking about what might be the backstory of Gal and how he got to the place that he's in. If you want to know that, you can watch the Sexy Beast TV series, the prequel to the film that for some reason just premiered on Paramount Plus in January 2024. Somebody decided that nearly 25 years later, everybody wanted a prequel to this movie. And maybe the best thing about Ben Kingsley's performance as Don is some random actor you've never heard of could play young Don.
Well, this is exactly what I was thinking. I was thinking about The Iron Cloth, the movie from last year, the Sean Durkin movie, where the biggest piece of criticism was the person who played Ric Flair did a terrible job of playing Ric Flair. It didn't encapsulate that charisma at all. And I just thought, like, unless you have the exact right actor, that's exactly what's going to happen here. No one can live up to what this was, or very few people can.
Yeah, and I haven't watched it. It was very poorly reviewed and seemed to have been premiered with almost no promotion. So I doubt it's going to continue, but it does exist on Paramount Plus. I can't imagine that. Also, as an actor, what is the upside to taking on that role and being compared to Ben Kingsley's performance? There's nothing good that's going to come of that.
I mean, the only thing I could think is like De Niro in Godfather 2 somehow pulled it off, right? So
that's the thought. You have to reach De Niro in Godfather 2 in order for this to be worth
That's right. Exactly. You have to be able to beat like acting teaching legends like Eli Wallach for your Oscar and like get up to Brando levels of excellence there. That's really what it is. So that's, you know, you have to really be at the height of your game to get there, I think.
It is a really weird project. Like you said that, but like, I just want to underline that. Like, it is crazy to just be like, let's make a series based on that movie where the one guy won an Oscar 25 years ago.
Right. Like, he didn't even win. He was just nominated.
He didn't win.
Right. Yeah. It's like so strange.
Right. And where like the idea of, oh, what were Gal and Don like in their early days as gangsters is not a question that anyone who watched this movie wanted to have answered. No. And I was just reading like some of the plot summaries. And not only that, but you know, we get a handful of references to the idea that Dee Dee had been a porn star before she marries Gal. And apparently the show explores her whole career in the adult film industry.
Thank God.
Well, it has to. What else, you know, what else could it do? It can't just be like, yeah, you know, hey, we need you for a heist. Nah, I'm good. No, you're going to do the heist, right? It has to show those other things. Who was Jackie? Who was H? Who were these people?
Yeah, I don't think Jackie is in it, but there is young H and young Teddy as well on the show, apparently.
I do like, I think H, you know, this was, I think, his last movie, the actor who played H, he died, Kevin Kendall. And he's just kind of like this, like, guy who is at once very enjoyable and at once such a wet noodle to be around. And you're like, what? He just nails it, though.
Yeah, he is good. I've never seen him in anything before. And as you said, he died before the movie was even released. This was his last performance. But it also, you wonder, because H is as well a retired gangster. Don is not attempting to recruit H. So kind of right. where does that land things on his career in the underworld?
And I haven't seen him either, but I think the Doctor Who fans would know him from the Mythmakers.
Okay, yeah. Kingsley, of course, has had a massive career beyond this. He has been nominated for an Oscar multiple times, even including after this was nominated for House of Sand and Fog, which is, I can't stand that. And I feel like that's the wrong.
It's a good movie.
It's an awful movie, and it has the wrong kind of over-the-top acting in it.
What about Jules?
I don't think I've seen, I'm not sure what that one is.
Oh, that just came out, right?
Yeah. Isn't that like the old people get a robot or an alien or something from last year?
Yeah. You're right. Yeah. I mean, and Kingsley is one of these guys, he's in his 80s now, I think. And he's one of these actors who will just do anything. And so his career is like Oscar nominated movie, B movie you've never heard of, blockbuster. And it just kind of ping pongs around there. You know, he's been in a bunch of Marvel movies. He's worked with Martin Scorsese on Shutter Island and Hugo.
And Hugo.
As you said, he was just in that Wes Anderson short. And yet he's also in like some shitty VOD thriller every now and then.
I marked down two movies that he's got coming up. It's interesting that we had mentioned him earlier. He's in the new Terrence Malick movie, The Way of the Wind.
Is that the Jesus one?
Sure, we'll go with that. And he's in a movie called Deep Water. And Dave, didn't we cover, I mean, didn't you watch a movie, just wasn't that called Deep Water? It sounds there, like there the exact same plot the, of the one that you watched.
The Ben Affleck one?
No, the one,
Dave. Isn't that what that's called? Where,
it's yeah. the one where the plane crashes and they have to survive with the sharks all around
that's,
them.
That's No Way Up, I think.
Or, okay, this one's called Deep like Water, and it sounds like the exact same plot of that.
And that's funny because Deep Water is, in fact, the name of that Ben Affleck movie, which is based on a Patricia Highsmith novel called Deep Water that has previously been adapted into other films called Deep Water.
Mm. Wait, which one is the Ben Affleck movie?
It's like erotic thriller with him and Ana de Armas.
Oh,
that
right,
was notorious
right, yeah.
for their relationship on set. It's not a good movie, but no. It did get a lot of attention. So, yeah, I mean, title aside, I think that's exactly that shark movie is exactly what I'm saying. That like Ben Kingsley is like, do you want to work with Martin Scorsese? Yeah. You want to be in this shark movie? Yeah. You know, he just wants to work.
Yeah, that's okay. We know a lot of actors just want to do the yeah. work and let them go. So Ray Winstone is in every movie ever made, Josh. Every gangster movie ever made, obviously The Departed. And, you know, he was also in Hugo. You know, The Gentleman, you had mentioned, he's in Damsel that just came out. So constantly working.
Yeah, he's all over the Netflix. And I mean, I think it's one of the reasons why his performance here is good is because he often is playing that Don Logan type character. He's playing the heavy, the intimidating gangster. I mean, that's what he does in The Gentleman. He's like the boss behind the boss on that show. And he's fine in it, but it's a very, like, you can imagine he just kind of did that part on autopilot. And what's cool here is that he's really playing against that expectation.
There's a movie called Nil by Mouth. Have you ever heard of this movie?
I may have seen that movie. Is that the one that Gary Oldman directed?
Yeah, and it's supposed to be a great movie, and I know Winstone's the star of this thing, but it's a very hard movie to find in America.
Yeah, I think I may have seen it on DVD years ago, and is it the one that was kind of, was it inspired by his like abusive childhood? Is that what I'm thinking of, or am I getting
that
wrong?
Yeah. You're thinking of Kenneth Branagh's film. From whatever, the Belfast. No, I'm just kidding. No, it was, I think you got it right.
Yeah, yeah. And I have seen it again, according to Letterboxd. I don't really remember much about it, but I think Ray Winstone is like the abusive father and he's playing that kind of intimidating, dangerous character, like I was saying, which is the opposite of what he does in this movie.
Right. He's quite charming in this movie. Ian McShane, of course, probably best known in America for Deadwood or American Gods. But again, this guy's working all the time. The John Wick series, of course, Dave's going to, I couldn't get away without mentioning mm-hmm. that for Dave, but he's in a movie coming up called Deep Cover. Three improv actors are asked to go undercover by the police in London's criminal underworld. Come on, give me that.
Ian McShane is one of those actors too, who has this incredibly distinctive voice that's so like melodious that all he has to do is say one word and you're like, oh, there's Ian McShane. He's about to enter this scene.
Yeah, I just rewatched Coraline the other day. He was in that.
Yeah. And going back, I don't know if we mentioned this in our Wuthering Heights episode from last season, but he did play Heathcliff in a 1967 version of Wuthering Heights.
All right. Way nice. To go, Ian McShane. I mean, that's, Amanda Redmond, who plays Dee Dee, is a big British TV actor, and James Fox, who was the banker Harry, Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, Sherlock Holmes, you know, stuff like
that. Yeah, yeah. Some of these lesser known British actors filling out the cast, but all doing a good job with the parts that they're given. So thoroughly enjoyable. I'm glad that we did this. So that is Sexy Beast. And that is this episode of Awesome Movie Year. You can yell at us online and on social media.
No one yells online at anybody.
No, everyone is reasonable and always takes no for an answer if that's the answer.
We're at awesomemovieyear.com, Awesome Movie Year on Facebook and Instagram, Awesome Movie Pod on Bury It Under Your Pool.
Yeah.
Jason Harris Comedy or Jay Harris Comedy on all those things. And you can find me at Go for Jason on Letterboxd, where Dave tells me I did not rank this movie high enough.
I tried to intimidate you into a 4-star
yeah,
rating.
Dave's no Don Logan, though.
Yeah, that's true.
You can find some old stuff from me at joshbellhateseverything.com. I am at Josh Bell Hates Everything on Facebook, at Signal Bleed on X, Twitter, and on Blue Sky, and on Letterboxd. And if you are on Letterboxd and you watch one of the movies we talk about here, #AwesomeMovieYear on your review. We would love to know what you think of any of the movies we cover. And you can listen to our producer, David Rosen's awesome podcast, Piecing It Together.
Check out Piecing It Together wherever you listen to podcasts. Follow us on social media at Piecing Pod and check me out on Letterboxd by David Rosen.
Jason, what's in our next episode?
Josh, it's a movie you demanded that we watch, which is crazy. You say it's your favorite movie ever. I don't know. Battlefield Earth. Bomb.
Yeah, not my favorite. But I, you know what? Maybe it will be my favorite because I've never seen it. And we will figure out how that goes. Tune in next time for Battlefield Earth. And thanks for listening to Awesome Movie Year.
Thank you for listening to Awesome Movie Year. Make sure to follow Awesome Movie Year on Facebook, at Awesome Movie Pod on Twitter, and at Awesome Movie Year on Instagram. And if you like the show, review us and rate us with 5 stars on Apple Podcasts.
An All Points West production, produced by David Rosen in Las Vegas.